Today is the 5th of January 2023, and the time is 3:03 p.m. My name is Preeti Sri Venkatram, and I'm conducting this interview over Zoom for the Making of Indian Conservation Project with Suprabha Seshan. I'm currently in my home in Bangalore, and she is in the Gurukula Botanical Sanctuary in Wayanad, Kerala. Thank you, Ms. Seshan, for agreeing to this interview. And I'd just like to ask you once that you consent to being interviewed and recorded for the Making of Indian Conservation Project.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so then maybe we can go right into this. And I'd like to begin by asking how you feel your work has intersected with India's conservation journey over the last 50 years. Where do you place yourself? How do you see your roles and responsibilities? And how do you see their relevance?
Yeah, we need to break that down. It's our work has really been about the conservation of rainforest plant species. And in the process of conserving them, we have also looked at how to rehabilitate species and also eventually into what's now called restoration ecology. Along with that, there's a lot of work done with mostly people from the area. And the whole thing stands on their shoulders, actually. So there's education, there's outreach, there's some kind of consultation and advocacy about how to care for the land, which of course includes the rivers and plants and animals, wildlife, people. Place has been around for a while, so it's about 50 years since this venture came into being. So that's roughly intersects with the time of the Wildlife Act coming into being, right?
Did this come about before then or after?
No, this has nothing to do with it. This place actually was a retreat, a place of solitude and reflection. And in the early years, it was just a contemplative retreat for one person who then, when he saw that forests were being cut, I think just began with a very simple response as to working with the destroyed plant species, the tender herbaceous flora. So there's not very many people working on the microflora of these forests, and that's our specialty. It had nothing to do with knowledge of what's happening on at a broader scale. It was a very direct response to felling of trees, and then these little plants that grow on them or under them, and then bringing them back. And it's just a refuge. It really is primarily a refuge.
How did you get involved with this?
Yeah, I came here in 1991 as a visitor. I'd heard about it, and then I came back again as a visitor, and we went up a local mountain. The person who started the place, Wolfgang Theurkauf, originally from Berlin, and then came and lived here with his wife Lilama, who's just from here. And he took a bunch of us up a mountain, Banasuramala, and that gave me a chance to see a kind of like the two extremes of this initiative, which is one is just individual plants and, if they're growing in places that look like they're going to be doomed. And then the larger landscape level, the picture, of these forests. So in one shot, I sort of that was a very evocative experience. And I had already spent some time looking at how the forest is really comprised of so many member species and member beings, and I had looked at agroecology in the prairies in Kansas in the US, and where a bunch of people are looking at prairie revival, but at the same time through agroecology. So this whole sense that the wheat farms, which are grasslands, have been the greatest destruction to the prairies, which are also a grassland. And how can the two be brought closer to each other? Can the wheat farm mimic a prairie? So that whole sense of agroecology was what brought me here. because I saw people locally in Wayanad are very familiar with all the plants and the sense that they could cultivate and restore parts of the forest that had been destroyed was what really intrigued me. And this was being done in a very simple way through horticulture, community-based conservation. It wasn't scientific in that sense, but it's very practical and very knowledge-based. And you know, the results are absolutely stunning on a very small scale. So that's what brought me here, just this sense that human beings could participate in the rewilding of a habitat. That's what brought me here.
Would you like to maybe share a bit more about some of your experiences working in this area and what exactly the work has entailed?
Yeah, so our work would broadly be defined, I mean, the term that we have come up with ourselves is gardening back the biosphere. More technical term would be ecosystem gardening. So then what the rainforest prior to industrial and urban influences, how it might have appeared, or what would it have been composed of, and then to use the skills of gardening, which is simply, you know, planting and collecting seeds and cuttings and growing up a place, maturing it in the form of a forest. And the forest here is, you know, the local forest is medium elevation wet evergreen rainforest. So it is, you know, it has enormous numbers of tiny plants. We think of rainforests as primarily of trees, but actually the mega diversity groups are actually the smaller plants. And in all the conservation efforts around the country, now more and more people are into it. But at that time, and certainly when I saw it, I did not see anyone else working on ferns and orchids and, you know, these very, very tender and really species by species to try and actually rewild a place that had been highly degraded. So now we have over 2,000 species under conservation cultivation, which is you know, one of the biggest repositories of rainforest species in the country. It's not large in terms of area, but it's very intense in terms of numbers of species. And the main imperative, of course, is the perception that more than 90% of the rainforest or of the Western Ghat biome has actually been completely replaced by industrial farming. And so you know, the terms that we would use is that this is really holocaustic proportions. You know, when you have over 90% of the biome gone or replaced or transformed in some way, you have no other word for it, you know. So then to go to all these places where there's either an opening up happening or felling happening or planting of exotic species is happening or roads or dams and so on, and to go to through the landscape and actually bring back plants that we believe are highly, highly threatened by the changes in both climate as well as you know, the form of the landscape itself, of the ecology itself, to bring them back and to give them another toehold in time for survival. So that's the main imperative of the place. And through that, we have come into restoration and rewilding and education and so on.
And how was it as an outsider to this landscape coming into this in the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, that's a journey in itself, no? So I was young and the place was very small and very intimate, and I hope it still retains that character. And at that time, the area was really poor because Wayanad is one of the, you know, the last districts in Kerala to have any form of, you know, education and support, let's say, to the peoples here. So it was very, very poor. And I just, you know, I was on an adventure, came and learned the language and met amazing human beings. And there, many of them are still here. And I, for me, the feeling, the thing that drove me was this whole question of, you know, where does the wild end and where, you know, where does a human end, you know? So where, you know, we make these distinctions and it seems quite false. The more you explore that question of, you know, where does wilderness begin and end? It just feels like, you know, that's an invented category in its first place, in the first place. And so my feeling at that time in my mid-20s was to really examine that by going to different places. And here I found this wonderful sort of interbeing of peoples who already had an intimacy with the plants and animals of the area. And then the Gurukula Botanical Sanctuary as its own venture, that it was really about coming close to the species. And the whole act of tending and caring and relating and learning and living amongst and, you know, and the place becoming wilder for your own presence there. All that seemed just like the thing I wanted to do, and that has stayed on. So the outsider effect is not so much now because there's a lot of people moving into Vayanad and, you know, it's become this tourist hub and it's no longer this quiet place. So I don't have that sense of it anymore, but at that time, but you know, the thing is Vayanad was open for settlement, in the late 50s and early 60s and late 60s and so on. So a lot of people were moving into the area from other parts of Kerala. So there was a settler culture. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, you know, the place has seen different groups of people migrate from other parts of the state. And so, you know, it didn't feel very, very as if I was, you know, an outsider in that sense.
could you maybe share a bit about, I don't know, maybe learnings or challenges over the years that you have faced?
Well, one is that this is the place where we're living together, a bunch of us, and also all the people who work here are just from within walking distance. So it's... you know, so it has sustained over 50 years that feeling that it is primarily people who live in the area that are caring for the place. And so for me, the challenge has been, you know, what comes in the form of ideas from the culture of ecology and ecological sciences and you know, the broader kinds of processes that work worldwide. And then this, you know, the sense of these relationships have gone on for a long time. You know, everybody in Kerala is so familiar with plants. And that's another thing that you see, that it's just the most normal thing to be planting. And then you come with your ideas of, you know, restoration ecology or invasive exotics or, you know, the rainforest structure, form and function and ecology, you know, so I came with those terms in my head, and having explored it, you know, I didn't want to go into academia, but I sort of started that in that way because I didn't know any other way by which I could come into conservation. And then you find, you know, this intimacy that is very old, and it's not all Adivasi people, but just it's the language between people and plants. And for me, that has been the journey, really, is to get away from the head, is to get away from ideas and concepts and imposing structures that come from, I would call, authoritarian techniques, you know, that we study and then we analyze and then we put all the data into the computer and then we then say this is good and this is bad. And meanwhile, there are people living in these places and they have their own idea of what is good and bad. And then meanwhile, there's the land itself, you know, the land is powerful, the forest is powerful, you know, what's happening as the exchange between, you know, different species, that is also very interesting to watch. So to be very close to primary observation, to keep it simple, to keep it close in some way and very physical, has been, I would say, my personal journey. For the others, perhaps it's been the sense that they have something to share to a, with a larger world. You know, that these are important skills that can be shared with other people. A lot of young people come here, and you know, walking in the forest, and you know, there's the Paniya way of seeing the forest, there's the Kurchan way of seeing the forest, and there's the settler culture, then there's you know, all of us who are, you know, cosmopolitan and so on. So that all of us have something to learn and all of us have something to share. And this can itself be this very fertile way of reconnecting with the natural world.
Related to what you've just been sharing, I think I'd like to ask how you'd place the different forms of knowledge in conservation, like, for example, formal scientific, indigenous, or experiential, and the relationships between them.
Yeah, I mean, that broadly describes it, no? Mm-hmm. What you've just said. What I tend to pursue with people, whoever it is just like through a conversation. And it doesn't matter which way you've come. You know, if someone has studied BSc botany, they're very welcome here. And a lot of first year botany students, or, you know, masters in botany, or, you know, PhD students, they, many people come here. And you know, all of North Kerala, all the colleges would have sent their first year botany students here. So we have that sense that we can have a conversation. And whichever way you come, whichever language you speak, whether it is science or whether it is something, you know, just that people here, everybody knows in Malayalam, you know, you have the vines, and then you have the herbs, and then you have the medicinal plants, and you have the trees, you have the herbaceous giant herbs, that there is another language also. And then there is the, you know, the primary language, which is simply that you are a creature in nature, which is that, you know, who's told you all these categories? Who's actually shaped your own perception? And maybe there are some filters to be checked there. So because I have been somewhat fluent in some different areas, I just pursue it through language and through questions and, you know, just a rigorous kind of sense of, hey, how did you come to think that? How did you come to believe that? And, you know, what's going on here right now? Which you could say is a sort of basis of science. But I think too much of what is happening nowadays is like the categories have come in before the perception has begun. You know, people are already, you know, you'll get a lot of people coming in who know about the rainforest, and they know about, you know, pteridophytes, or, you know, the ferns and so on. They have the language, but they've never seen them. So how do you come close? You have to drop many of these categories first, and then you have to engage, and then you can draw, you can write, you can make music, you can walk, you can climb trees, you can plant, you can learn from different people, because there's so many different peoples here in this particular area. So that's what I do. Mm-hmm. It's not about this or that. It's really about using whatever it is that we have. And so many naturalists come, and they've all seen, you know, the wonderful new books that have come out, the field guides to these different, you know, trees, or, you know, endemic woody plants of the Western Ghats or whatever. But the idea is that you actually have so much more. The journey is even greater when you... you know, you are prepared to learn from the forest itself.
Maybe asking also about things at a little broader level, I think I'd want to know that if you were to reflect on the last 50 years of conservation in India, what would you see as some major successes and failures?
At the very broadest level, you know, there's only still some 2,000 tigers after 40 years of tiger conservation, you know, and 3,000 or more crores have been spent on tigers, you know. So I don't know what's going on there. At the very broadest level, I think greater and greater disasters, because everything is affected now, no? But at the same time, the successes that we celebrate are the ones that have the fact that you can have something that is not, say, state-driven, but community-driven now, because so much of policy has gone towards communities, other than some kind of state, what do you say, some instrument of the state to rather discussion with communities. I would say that is a great thing. That is a great thing that has happened, you know, in the last, say, 15 years or so. The re-recognition that it is finally people who live in these areas who actually should take it into their hands to see. So it
do you
makes
find
it
that
less
that's happening? Or do you find that that's happening on a large scale in India?
No. Not that it's happening on a large scale, but that it policy shifted for some years that it acknowledged that, no?
Mm-hmm.
So protectionism that has come from the state to something that is coming from the community is acknowledged. But again, in the last few years, that is now, it's a last year or so, and it's, there's so many of the things that are being, with the Forest Rights Act and so on, that it's, everything's being watered down, and areas that you thought were, you know, protected for posterity, they're becoming weaker. And the whole infrastructural projects, that got the giant, gargantuan infrastructural projects at work, which to me is the one thing that we actually need to talk about. We need to talk about, you know, the dominant culture's infrastructure projects. If we don't talk about that, then everything else that we talk about is just like, you know, the Nazi doctor thing, you know, that we're all heading towards this total madness. Do you know the whole Nazi doctor thing? The fact that at the time of the, you know, the gas chambers, that the prisoners were inevitably going towards their doom, but there were genuine doctors within the concentration camps that would care if the prisoner had a fever, and they would give them an aspirin, and, you know, they would might delay their death by a day or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel that conservation has gone that way, that we make these very, very sort of superficial changes. And some of them are, I would say, are absolutely necessary, that you have tribunals, or you have, you know, people are empowered in some way to take decisions about the forest that they live in and so on. But if you have river linking, if you have a giant, you know, hundreds and hundreds of dams coming in, if you have, you know, machinery, you know, JCBs everywhere, and then you talk about conservation, it just seems like it's a bit of a distraction, really, from the imperative, which is it's upon all of us to see that. Massive roads, trains, you know, ports everywhere, and just cement and steel and machinery, you know, everywhere. And we don't challenge that, but we look at, you know, how many tigers do we have, or, you know, that kind of thing.
Is there anything else that you would say that has we've got right in the past 50 years,
but
or something that you
we,
think has
Stacey,
worked well?
Who's the we?
Well, I think that you think has happened right or has been a success.
No, but who's the we? So, you know, I don't identify, I think, mm-hmm, I mentioned that in the mail, with this entity that is, while it is caring for the people, as it seems to say it is doing, it is also building massive war machinery. You know, so as we speak, the numbers of fighter planes, or, you know, one warship, the carbon footprint of one warship would take care of the carbon footprint of entire populations of different states. So I feel like, what are we getting right if we have the carbon footprint of the military alone increasing?
Mm-hmm.
Which then puts into total insignificance what the rest of us are doing. Because the scale of that, and that's the big, that's the elephant in the room in all the, in the, you know, the COP meetings, right? The COP meetings, they don't talk about warfare. And they don't talk about the machinery that is required to make the instruments of warfare. And they don't talk about the footprint of each of these, which, you know, is just massive. And so I feel that as a conservationist, I do everything in my power to talk about that, because I feel that it's so easy to bring back the natural world. The natural world is actually so powerful that it will come back. But if you have this scale of attrition that is caused by massive infrastructural projects, then everything that you and I do, although it's important for that piece of land and for that species and for that, you know, that community of people, unless we're addressing this very large destructive process, I feel like, okay, so that's, we can talk about it if you want. What did we get right? Well, there's a lot of people talking about restoration ecology now, so that's great. But then they're talking about so many different kinds of restoration ecology that, again, you have just like gender running into different alphabetical, you know, you have restoration ecology running into its various alphabets of high intervention to no intervention to, you know, so we get caught in our definitions, and they feel very important and it's right, but it's not, it doesn't address, say, for instance, patriarchy. It doesn't address omnicidal imperative of large developmental, you know, processes.
With regard to restoration ecology particularly, are there any specific successes and failures?
Well, between all the different restoration initiatives, I think there's a whole bunch of us who've come together to form the Ecological Restoration Alliance of India. Mm-hmm. And, you know, between all our projects, it is tiny.
Sorry? When was this formed?
This was formed in the last, actually by NCF was one of the, was the primary driver behind this, you know, Sridhar Shankaran and Divyamutha and others. They got a whole bunch of us together and said, look, can we create an alliance? And they involved very different types of projects and different types of practitioners. You know, not all are scientists, but we've had a long, long story with recovering the land to health. So between all of us, though, this, the total size of our initiatives is so small, you know, compared to the scale of, say, the destruction, or the, say, the scale of plantations, for instance, you know, the it's very, very small. So it's wonderful that there is interest, and it's wonderful that just on an informal basis, we will have so hundreds of people asking us in a year, ourselves at Gurukula Botanical Sanctuary, oh, how do we do this? How can we care for the land? How can we care for native species and so on? But the fact is that, you know, you will have rambutans being planted on a large scale in our own neighborhood. So rambutans are an exotic tree species. So it feels wonderful that we're having rambutans available in the market, but that's not restoration ecology. You know, that's completely against it. So the scale of the agricultural, for instance, I really believe that agriculture and restoration are completely opposed to each other. So if you don't have changes in agriculture, you cannot have sufficient changes that are healthy enough for a whole biome to recover, because agriculture is the dominant kind of, you know, phenomenon in any landscape, right? But the government pushes agricultural policies that are completely destructive and are very dependent on, say, petrochemicals still, or, you know, monocultures, or, you know, now GMOs are the big debate and so on. So how can you have health of an ecosystem come back when you have such destructive policies that coming from other areas? So I don't personally feel that at the scale that is required, that something significant is happening yet. I'm not saying it won't happen, that it can't happen, and I'm very, very happy anytime somebody gets into this, this spectrum of approaches to conservation. But I'm not, you know, I'm not optimistic about the system. And I feel all these acts, that they come out of a system that has no connection with the land.
What would be your vision for environmental conservation in the future in India?
Well, first of all, there has to be a different agriculture. That has to completely change. That is an agriculture that resembles the biome that it's where it's at. So if you have large irrigation projects, for instance, in the middle of a dry area and you're trying to grow rice in the middle of the desert, that's completely counterproductive. So agriculture has to change, education has to change, health has to change, the sense
Could you
of
maybe like
the
elaborate
land
on
is.
what some of these changes you think ought to entail?
For instance, in our area, if you want to have an agriculture that resembles the forest, the traditional farms were really good. They resemble the forest in some way. But if you have like bananas for, making chips for export to some city, that is completely counterproductive because it's very intensive on chemicals and it is a monoculture and it completely, is very bad for wildlife and so on. So why are we growing bananas for making banana chips? Let people grow bananas in their own home garden. So that sense of decentralizing agriculture, such that it becomes really you go to some kind of self-sufficiency for farmers. And linkages with people living in the city so that children can come to these farms where the forest is growing up or whatever that is natural and native to that area. So the agriculture has to look different. It has to look completely different. I have to be able to look out of my window and see a forest.
You also spoke of health.
Health, obviously, the health of the biome, the health of the planet, the health of human beings are all interconnected, right? They go together. You can't have a polluted minefield and have healthy people living there. They have to go together then, and that is perhaps the greatest part of the disconnect that has happened, is that I'll just open the door. This little doggy wants to come in.
Yeah.
The body is a biological being. If it's in an area that is completely sprayed with chemicals, what is the health of that person, right? So ecology, planetary health, and human health go, they are the same. They're not different. And education and educating towards a way of life that you are back in community with the land itself and
What do you think
supporting.
can be done differently about education?
This is a very complex question. I don't know if we have the time to go into it here. We are educators, all of us here, and we have been working towards a different sort of education. There other than these national disasters that happen, there are also what is being called amongst educators as the rational disaster, highly
We do have
competitive.
time. I'm happy to get into it with more
No, I
detail.
mean, what I mean is that it's not a simple answer, no, that when people have aspirations and when people have very broken agriculture, that self-sufficiency and the land-based economies have been shattered by various policies, and they're being driven to work elsewhere, then they have to go to schools that then get estrange them further from the land and then put them in this nowhere place, which is they become migrant labor, or they become, factory workers, or all in the process of an aspiration. But the aspiration comes after, TV has entered every home and the agricultural economy has been completely destroyed, and, population has increased, and the forests are, alienated from people who live around them. There's so many rules and regulations as to who can go in and who can't go in. And the water has been spoiled, and the air is now, foul, and cancer is going up, and they go somewhere to search for a better life. I'm not the person who's going to tell them don't go to school, but I would ask the question, is there a better education possible that doesn't alienate you further? and what is going to give you the real skills. The real skills are not just intellectual skills. The real skills are to do with being understanding ecology, understanding your own connection with the land. And the hard skills that we teach here are how to grow plants, how to grow back the forest, how to clean up the river. You know, so it's very practical. The whole thing is very practical. And this is going to be, you know, entire populations of people are going to be stranded if food supplies run out. You know, we saw that with the virus, with the pandemic, right? How all the supply chains had been affected. And then then people start growing food on their terraces and vegetables in their balconies and so on. So education that is towards community and towards land and towards a different way of life is something that I would promote.
Is there anything else that you would like to add as part of your vision for conservation in the country?
We have to challenge infrastructure, massive infrastructural projects. So you can't have the beautiful life without also, which is people living in community with nature, I would say is my definition of a beautiful life. You can't have it without challenging those forces that don't want you to have this beautiful life. And it's everywhere. So how do you counter that? How do you talk to authoritarian techniques, essentially?
How do you think that can be done?
Well, the dialogue has to happen. There have to be enough people who are asking these questions and looking at the real connection. The connection is so obvious once you start to see it. Like, for instance, the fossil fuels infrastructure, the transportation infrastructure, and then the mining infrastructure. Between the three of them, they've basically destroyed the planet. So if you see that, then you're not going to be so happy about further kind of massive infrastructural, you know, interventions. So say, for instance, renewable energies. You know, everybody's going on about hydrogen and solar and this and that. But if it requires the importation of resources based on mining fossil fuels or transportation, it can't be sustainable. It means it's coming from some land somewhere, or the water, or, you know, it's coming from the body of the earth. And it means that there are probably some people living there who don't want it to be taken from them. So they will be displaced. So when you see these connections, you have to then ask, how can human community exist if these are completely ravaging the body of the earth?
I think my next question would be how you foresee the future of wild species and spaces in India, and what gives you worry, what gives you hope?
Well, the IUCN has some figure that there's, I don't know, 150 species a day that is going extinct in the world. You know, this includes big, small, microbial, whatever. So that's, if you do the basic numbers, if it's 150 species a day, that comes to whatever, 50,000, 60,000 species a year. That is, you know, that is outrageous. It's outrageous that we don't talk more about it. Because this is the fabric of the biosphere. This is the basis on which human community exists. So this gives me, you know, has given me decades of anxiety in terms of anger, I would say, that we just think that there is a future without all these other beings. And it's a lot of species, right? It's not just the charismatic megafauna. And luckily, there's been some kind of a shift towards appreciating frogs and damselflies and butterflies and small plants. But the very how a forest comes about, and how that's connected with human welfare, that is very far still. It's very abstract. it's not implemented, you know, with the kind of rigor we saw with the pandemic, the kind of rigor with which everything happened overnight. But nobody has considered the end of the biosphere with that kind of rigor.
How do you think that ought to be considered going forward?
Well, how was it considered during the lockdowns? So I would just say, let the military machinery stop for one day. I'm not going to ask human beings. I'm not going to ask you to stay at home. How about asking, you know, the military machinery to stop for a day?
Is there anything about the future that gives you hope?
Hope is a funny word. And I have friends who talk about the difference between hope and false hope. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people are caught in false hope. They think that people who are addicted to a particular way of life will change. And, you know, it's well known that anyone who's addicted is very difficult to give up an addiction. So the addiction to the modern way of life and to the modern system, you know, this way of being human, that is not going to change very quickly. But I do believe that communities worldwide, and also the nature itself herself, is a mysterious force, and I do believe that we have to leave the window open there, that things can change.
Is there anything else you'd like to add in terms of how you foresee the future and other things that give you worry and hope?
You know, I would like to ask you some questions.
Okay, but before that, I'd also want to know if there's anything that we haven't covered as yet that you would like to speak about.
Well, the beauty of the earth, mm-hmm. the beauty of nature, the beauty of human community, the affection, the love, that it is possible to live a different way. You know, I think this is what we have to embrace in our imaginations. And I think this Indian people have it's still going in places, that connection with the natural world. And so I'm a fan of beauty, and I'm a fan of nature's own resilience and of human resilience. So I think for me, that's where the attention should go.
I think if there's nothing else that you would like to add, we can end this session.
Mm-hmm.
Or I could stop the recording.